did back in March and April when we didn't know what we were dealing with.
Yeah, it seems like everyone has learned a lot.
Hello, this is Matthew Tombers, and you're listening to WGXC, Acre, Catskill, Hudson.
Find out where the music takes you on the next Deep Threes when RHA gets together in the south of France for an improvised reunion. Plus guitar riffs for a new space age from Cosmic Letdown and a stop in Prohibition-era Chicago with Brian Carpenter. Deep Threes, music beyond boundaries for a digital world.
Tune in to Deep Threes after the noon news on Monday at WGXC 90.7 FM.
Hi, I'm Andy Reid.
And I'm Mike Porter.
You're listening to Catskill Cabin Conversations on WGXC Acre 90.7 FM.
On each show, invited guests will be asked to discuss a number of items that they intend taking with them on their Catskill Cabin getaway. As we discuss their chosen items, it is hoped that you, the listener, will enjoy getting to know that person a little bit better.
Usually at this point, we would introduce our guest. However, given that today marks the end of our sixth year, we would like to take the opportunity to reflect on some of our best moments from 2020.
You are about to hear excerpts from shows with Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Naomi Kabalkin-Bunnenberg, Nina Heath, George Patterson, Thomas Reed, Jackie Lotz, Kyle Shea, Krista Mason, Christopher Labanca, and Brian Mulroney.
These are some of our favorite moments, and we hope that you enjoy listening to them as much as we do.
Now, I was doing a little bit of reading about knives. In 2013, a one-inch blade was discovered in Spain. It's 1.4 million years old, and it was carried by hominids. So the ancient ancestors of humans, hominids, like ancient hominids, yes, ancient people.
All right.
And obsidian knife blades are the thinnest of all blades. They're 3 nanometers wide, 10 times sharper than a razor blade, and those are made from volcanic glass. It's unlikely you're going to be using one of those. Some surgeons would like to use them for the incredible precision, but apparently they flake a little bit, and there's the chance that you could leave pieces of obsidian in the patient, so they have not been yet approved for surgical use. But so you're taking a quality chef knife. I'm thinking it's probably not obsidian. It's probably not going to be 1.4 million years old. Tell us about the quality chef knife you're going to bring.
So it's funny. I'm going on vacation in 17 days, not that I'm counting, but we're renting a house. And I know one of the first things I put on my list was that I need to bring one of my good chef knives because I hate getting to a place and trying to prepare food with a crappy knife. It's not enjoyable. It makes preparing food absolutely a nightmare. I'm a little bit of a nerd. I do not consider myself a chef. I consider myself at best a line cook. But I do appreciate knife skills and, I want to be able to work quickly and efficiently, and I don't feel like if you have a poopy knife, you're going to do that. So I bring a good knife with me everywhere.
Julianne Fast?
Yes, sir. I took a couple of classes so I could do that because I chopped the tip of my pinky off back in the day. Oh. I learned the hard way. So I invested in a few knife skills classes. But yeah. I know that having a good quality knife and making sure that it is sharp is critical to, prepping your food efficiently and effectively.
So, Brian, your first item that you would take on your Catskill Cabin getaway is a Swiss Army knife. And these are manufactured by Victorinox. The term was actually coined by American soldiers after World War II due to the difficulty they had in pronouncing Offiziersmesser, which is the German officer's knife. So
yes.
Swiss Army's knife. That's the best I can do. Sorry.
That's good. And, yeah, I'll take it. A customer gave me one as a gift. A guy called Andy Weir. Andy came in one time and he said, there's a present for you. And I was really happy, but I didn't realize just how useful it is. It's got everything. Scissors, a nail file, bottle opener, tin opener, 3 blades, 2 screwdrivers, all contained in this little thing that's about 3.5 inches long. And the quality is phenomenal. You know, the quality is the best steel. It's just a great tool. So if you're going to be in a cabin in upstate New York, especially in the winter, I would want my Swiss Army knife with me.
Now, in the original television series MacGyver, as well as its 2016 reboot, MacGyver frequently used a Swiss Army knife. In particular, in one episode, he fashioned a poison dart blowgun to save himself from some assailants. Here's a little bit of trivia for you, gentlemen. If you're MacGyver fans, which maybe you are, aren't, I don't. Mm-hmm. What was MacGyver's first name?
Frank.
Frank MacGyver. What do you say there, Andy?
Stevie.
Angus MacGyver. And fitting for you, gentlemen, it's sad, but I only just now realized that it's a Scottish name.
It is a Scottish name.
very, very Scottish name. But he was in the show embarrassed about his first name. So it went like this was a running thing for years where he would not say his first name.
Now, one thing that I remember our former guest and my good friend, George Patterson, he was on the show and he wanted to bring a Swiss Army knife. Uh-huh. And he said, but no, the normal size one. See the big one you see advertised the store. He says, I wanted to bring that one. I can just see him. A big giant knife, you know.
I know the ones, the promotional
like a
ones.
A bear or something, you know.
This one has an attachment for a battery and it turns into a chainsaw. In your first item is going to be the jigsaw of the USS Greer.
Yes.
That FDR would be bringing on his Catskill Cabin getaway.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways you could call it macabre in respect that it's a jigsaw of the first ship that American ship that was hit by the Germans in the Second World War. And you could say, well, why would they want to be reminded of such a travesty? But as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, he loved the Navy, and he played a big part in the U.S. Navy.
Assistant Secretary of the Navy.
Yeah.
Just like his cousin Teddy Roosevelt.
And I think the seas, and I think America overcoming the Germans and the Italians in the Second World War meant a lot to him. And this actual incident, the Greer incident,
yeah,
I think that kicked off things for America in a very particular way. They began to give huge amount of financial assistance and started protecting, you know, the interests of the allies.
Yes. Beginning to abandon neutrality.
Yeah. And I think that this jigsaw puzzle would be a reminder of what was to come and how he played a fantastic part in overcoming the access of evil during the Second World War.
Yeah. And you're right. He did have an affinity for the Navy, for sailing, for boating. He spent, when he had first contracted polio, time on a houseboat, kind of a little more solitary.
Mm-hmm.
And the day he...
Almost like a convalescence.
Yeah. And the day he got polio, he was at camp, I believe, with his family, and they had gone out on a boat, and they had seen a little fire on an island and put it out, and he came home and said he felt weird. Just limbs felt weird his body. And so he went to bed, and when he woke up...
He couldn't walk.
Yeah, he couldn't get his legs to move. And such a bizarre thing, polio, this virus attacks. And there's no rhyme or reason as far as doctors could really tell.
One of the things that there were specialists were suggesting was that there's a possibility it wasn't polio. It was Guillain-Barre syndrome.
Oh, okay.
However, it's been concluded that even if it was I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Guillain-Barre syndrome, even if it was at the time, the treatments at the time wouldn't have been any different, and it wouldn't have made any difference to the conclusion of his physicality.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, terrible.
I did a jigsaw last October while I was off work for a couple of weeks, and I've got another one. My mum bought me one for Christmas and I've not touched it yet. So I think the next couple of weeks I'm going to make this into a solid item, a picture. There it's there for George to see and for you to see as well, Mike.
Oh, look at that.
So this is an iconic picture.
Right. It's a picture I actually have tattooed onto my arm.
That's right.
I'll get out of town.
So there you are.
Wow.
I'm going to do that that jigsaw of the tattoo that's on George's arm. It's Billy McNeil, whose nickname was Caesar. And it's a picture of Billy holding up the European Cup. And he was the first British captain, first Scottish captain, to lift the European Cup in 1967.
Which is the premier club competition in soccer in the world. It's the world's number one competition. It's known as the Champions League these days.
But it's the most iconic, well, one of the most iconic pictures in Celtic's history. And that's
he passed away a year ago, Billy.
Of Alzheimer's.
He did, yeah.
Which was unfortunate. And there's a big statue outside the stadium now of Billy. And it's, you know, a fantastic statue, beautiful statue.
Right, so Thomas, your first item that you would like to take with you on your COVID Catskill cabin getaway is art supplies.
Yeah, so I said art supplies because, I mean, recently I've done some watercolours and you know, working with chalks and stuff. I was last year, it was oil paints or acrylic. So, and obviously I like drawing. So I just take a variety of stuff because, I mean, during the lockdown, it's something that was really, you know, I was getting enthusiastic about again. And now that I'm back at work, it's kind of, I'm annoyed at myself that I've never done more than, you know, I bought stuff and never used it. Or, and it, you know, there's things there that I wanted to get done and never did. And it's, I'm going to find it hard to get it done or to find time. Because obviously when you're working, you've got kids. And...
Well, every time I spoke to you, you were painting, but albeit the kitchen and the hallway.
different types of painting.
And a serious note, Mike, Thomas sent me a picture that he drew for me of Laurel and Hardy. So I'll show you it later on once we finish the show. Beautiful. So
excellent.
Thank you. Thank you, Thomas.
It was I was the oil paint. It was the watercolours. I started doing a bit of watercolour paint.
Right.
So
that was
watercolours.
Very impressive.
No, I'm not. Actually, I'm far too lazy to be vegan. I could get by, I think, okay without meat, but I would miss fish too much. And I'll be honest, cheese. I really enjoy my dairy.
Yeah.
Right. But what Lulu's does really, really nicely. Have you guys had like the Impossible Whopper or anything?
Oh, yeah.
I've had the Impossible Burgers, yeah.
Yeah, so it's kind of, it's like impossible that it tastes as close to beef as it does. And that was something that I think Lulu's and I think good vegan food does really, really well is it's like, nope, I don't even miss the meat. They had a like a buffalo cauliflower wrap and it tasted just like I was eating buffalo chicken. And I was like, nope, this is great. I'm sold.
I've actually had buffalo cauliflower wrap as well. The local store here has a little cafe. And
How was it?
I don't like blue cheese, and I forgot to tell them to take the blue cheese off.
That would spoil it, I would think,
and
yes.
And it kind of tainted the taste for me. But other than that, you know, I've had buffalo cauliflower, and it's really, really nice, you know?
Yeah, so, I think the vegan recipes have come a really long way, and one of my favorite cookbooks right now is called Thug Kitchen, and it's basically, you know, give a bleep about what you put in your body, what you eat, and it's all these vegan recipes, and it's great. They have some really, really excellent stuff in there, and I'm all too happy to cook it. So
yeah, my girlfriend Julia's daughter Caitlin, she is vegan, and it's kind of taught me a few things, as you said, you know, about you know, there are a lot of meals that you can eat that you don't really have to think too hard about.
But, yeah.
But I think one of the things is you come home at night from work, you're tired, and you're like, right, would you prepare? You
right.
know, rather than just throwing a burger on the grill, but, you know, would you prepare, you know?
You know, no, I'm absolutely with you, Andy, because 100%, because it's way easier for me to make. I haven't made. We don't really eat beef around the house since when my wife was pregnant 3 years ago. She couldn't stand the sight, the smell, the taste of beef, and so we had sort of gotten it out of our diets for the most part. And so we sort of never reintroduced it. We replaced a lot of things with like turkey. So we do like turkey burgers and really enjoy those. It's way faster and easier for me to make a turkey burger. Yeah. than it is for me to make like the lentil white bean burgers that like the vegan burgers that are yep. tasty. But you know, you gotta put them together. You gotta let them set and then make them so that they don't just crumble. And yeah. Again, I'm with you 100%. You get home and you're just like, okay, how much time do I feel like investing in this meal? Yeah. This is the thing that's going on the grill.
Yeah. You know, that's what we did on Monday. We actually had a meatless Monday with Beyond Burgers that I cooked up. And it was really good. I just made some patties that you can get kind of like a package of the ground Beyond beef and made patties, salt and pepper, grilled up some onions and some cheese. And you eat the thing and with the seasoning and stuff, I kind of forget that I'm eating anything but a hamburger. Pretty good. You know,
yeah, really good. So Andy, has your girlfriend's daughter, has she introduced you in recipes that you're like, this is a knockout recipe, I love it? Because I'm always on the lookout for more recipes. I do most of the cooking in my house, and I'm always looking for good recipes.
She does make good, mac and cheese, you know, vegan mac and cheese.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So what she does is she soaks cashews overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And then she liquidizes them, and then she uses that as, you know, she adds ingredients, mm-hmm. herbs and stuff, and that creates the creaminess of the cheese, and then she'll use vegan pasta, and hey presto, you've got some vegan pasta.
That's awesome.
You know,
that's
mac
awesome.
And cheese. It's really, really nice. There's like some cheeses, some you know, vegan pizzas and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But as you said earlier, there's a lot of things, and Mike mentioned as well, there's a lot of things going on in terms of, you know, catering for the lazy people or the tired people like us that can yep. throw on a Beyond Burger instead of a meat burger, you know?
Yeah, so, yeah.
So there are companies catering to that, you know, rather than having to
make it,
you know, steep cashews overnight and all that, you know?
Just make it more accessible. I think a lot of us are, at least I know I was, sort of intimidated by all the prep that had to go into it and worried that it was going to come out bland. But ever since starting to cook from this cookbook, my spice cabinet has gotten a lot bigger. So I've got a lot more of those staples, and I feel like I'm not quite as afraid of trying a new recipe because there are so many good options for vegan food. And like you say, Andy, like, as they make some of these more accessible so that I don't have to, you know, soak the cashews overnight and everything. I'm more inclined these days to sometimes just go, that's what I want. We've been trying to cook more, since the pandemic started. But there are also nights where it's like, no, we're going to order takeout from a local place, see if we can't support it. And, you know, not that our business alone could keep anybody going, but really trying to focus on a lot of local places.
50 people say that, then, you know,
exactly our thought. So we want to make sure that, you know, when we eventually come out the other side of this, that the places we really like, places like Lulu's, there's a great Ethiopian restaurant near us that we really want to make sure sticks around. So exactly like you say, if 50 other people are thinking the same thing, it's like, hopefully we keep them going.
Your first item that you'd like to take on your Catskill cabin getaway is
a foraging cookbook. Bare bones, like survival, like there's nothing there. I've got no electricity or anything, in which case I'd have to go and forage my food, etc. I have like the comforts of a nice spice cabinet. And,
you get nothing.
A refrigerator.
You get nothing.
All right. So then I'm gonna get a nice foraging cookbook. Which I actually found a couple really good ones online, but Mark Bittman is the best cookbook writer. He works for the Times, and he has done one of my favorite cookbooks, which is How to Cook Everything. It's like a Bible. It's so big. And then he has How to Cook Everything Vegetarian. He just did How to Bake Everything. I think he has one that's like How to Cook Everything Fast. But I love how all of his cookbooks have great stories before the recipe. So it's not just something to prepare. There's a story behind it, which I figured it would keep me entertained while I am up in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
But if I really had to go out and get dirty in the dirt, I would want like a proper foraging cookbook.
Now, Thomas, your next item or items is fishing equipment.
You know, you can't go into the woods or go camping or without taking fishing rod, or fishing line, you know, and be it fly fishing or be it, bait fishing. Done it all, loved it all. And that just, when you ask about going to the cabin, I just think of in the woods, camping and with nature. And when I think of that, I just automatically think fishing. And if I go to these places and I don't fish, I feel as though I've missed an opportunity. Even though most times I go fishing, I don't catch it.
Yeah.
You would love Mike's cabin. There's a little river right next to it. Mm-hmm. Beautiful, isn't it, Mike? I don't know if there's a fish in that wee river.
There is just little. They're called creek chubs. It's kind of like big minnows.
Right.
But there are some creeks. I have caught brook trout and some of the creeks in that area. But you have to find them. Brook trout can be finicky, I think.
In what way?
They're really sensitive to temperature. They're really intelligent, and they get spooked easily.
Sitting there with a pipe and all that.
Yeah. I say, that gentleman is trying to snag one of us. Shall we carry on downstream?
Yeah. Fish with an English accent?
Yes. Well, that's how they are in the Catskills. But
that's how people do when they smoke pipes.
Yeah.
People sound when they smoke pipes.
Exactly. But yeah, a lot of world-class fishing, trout fishing in the Catskills, fly fishing, the Esopus Creek, I believe, and some of the other waterways.
We had a few stories from one of our previous guests.
That's right. Judd Weisberg.
Judd Weisberg. Classic story. The final cast. Remember?
Yep. Biggest fish he'd ever caught in the Catskills.
Yeah, mate. Thomas, you need to listen to Judd Weisberg. So.
I think I did. I did listen to it.
Said salmon fishing is fishing of 1,000 casts. And it might be the 1,001st cast that you catch the fish.
Yeah, I've never caught a salmon.
No?
Did you have a Back to Basics book in school?
In school?
What do you mean by that, Kyle? Back to Basics book?
So there actually is a book that's called Back to Basics. And it's funny, for the longest time, up in Canada, this is one of the books that we had at the cabin. And for the longest time, I'd flip through it and we'd just, you know, read every page and every square inch of it. And, you know, what it actually talks about is everything from, like, you know, how to introduce cats to each other, to skinning a rabbit, to watering your garden, or, like, how to clear land and build a house, and with regards to things like the direction of the wind blowing. And it gets, like, super, super detailed, and it's just, like, this fun...
Raising livestock.
Yeah, it's got everything. It really has everything in it.
Enjoying the longest... harvest. Yeah. House the longest... skills and crafts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And for the longest time, I knew every page of the book, and it wasn't until kind of recently that I realized that we had, like, the Canadian variant of the book. So when I actually saw, like, the US version, it was very similar in every regard, but it was just, like, some very small, I don't remember what the exact differences were, but
how to order a Big Mac at McDonald's. See. How to order a Big Mac at McDonald's. You always want a supersize.
How to order your Nick Tahoe's garbage plate.
Hey, there's a good shout out to the Rochester region, the garbage plates.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, you two should know what that means.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. You know, though, somehow the first time I think I had a garbage plate was when I was dating my wife, Nicole.
Yeah.
That was the first time I'd ever had a garbage. Somehow I never made it out to Rochester. I think I heard my uncle lived off of them for a while when he lived in Rochester.
But God, how long did he last?
He's still kicking. He's doing good. He was actually in the, it was during his, I think, his bodybuilding years. So I think that's how he kept himself in check. But for the listeners who don't know, a Nick Tahoe or any restaurant in the Rochester area, a garbage plate is a couple hot dogs, a couple cheeseburgers thrown on top of baked beans, macaroni salad, coleslaw, and it just looks like a plate of garbage.
French fries. A meat sauce over the top of it.
Yes.
And you usually get one when you're drunk.
That's a Frank Red Hot sauce.
It tastes beautiful. And then you wake up in the morning and you go, oh my God.
It's true that the establishments are frequented by inebriated youth in the wee hours of the morning.
They are delicious, though. We've tried to make them. We do yearn for them sometimes out here in California.
Hey,
what's it called out there? A Golden Gate.
Hey, that's pretty good. Oh my gosh, Kyle, you and Jenna have to open a restaurant.
A Golden Gate plate.
Yeah. And hey, you know, now there's Beyond Beef, there's Impossible Meat. You could have a pretty wicked vegetarian, and it would taste just like a regular garbage plate, but it would be entirely even vegan. You could do even a vegan garbage plate. It'd be really good.
Put on some bacon as well.
I don't know if they've come along quite as well with that, but like Impossible Meat, Beyond Meat, that stuff is good. I've used it for, especially Impossible. It's just not that. I was looking online today. It's like $70 to have 20 hamburgers shipped to your house. So it works out to be like $12 a pound or something. And it's just like, that's a lot for a hamburger. But I don't know. I wish they would sell it in stores. It's not quite in stores here yet.
They do sell it in stores.
Like Wegmans, but not anywhere around me. Impossible.
Well, if I see some, I'll bring you some up.
That'd be awesome. I'll pay you for it. Stock me up. I'll fill the freezer.
Bloody right, you'll pay me for it.
$200 for 5 cheeseburgers.
I'll cook it and I'll be like, no, no.
But. Yeah.
That's when Mike snapped.
Give me my cheeseburger. Now, your next item that you would like to take on your Catskill Cabin getaway, Chris, is a notebook and pen.
Mm.
What would you be doing with this notebook and pen?
So this is what I have learned about myself over the years. I have found that things slip through my mind. If I think it's important, I can retain totally useless factoids and information, but I can't retain anything that's important, whether it be an idea for a play I'm working on or an educational program or whatever, or a chore that I have to take care of. So I have taken to writing everything down, especially because what I've also learned is that I could be working on something. I might be working on a grant proposal. And I think, ooh, this is a thing that I should take care of. And what I'll do is I'll switch gears and I'll start doing this other thing. And so I've really tried to break the habit of jumping from project to project or from thought to thought. And the only way I can do that is by parking lotting it. So
yeah.
I have my, you know, I've always got a pen and paper handy. Because physical is not the word I'm looking for, but I am a very physical person. I'm a very tactile person is the word I'm looking for. A very tactile person.
Tactile.
So,
textile.
Electronics.
Made of wood.
Yeah, no, not quite that. I need. I need. I need something. In my...
He's gonna have a hard time against the dragon.
Mean, hopefully, I don't ever reach that point of needing a wooden leg. Hopefully, it's made of a nice wood, I suppose. but I write. I write things down so that I don't lose them, but also I can put them out of my brain. Except if is it going to grow under me? Because if it's going to grow,
you wake up in the morning, you're 2 feet tall,
cockeyed, right?
2 feet more, larger than you were the day before.
Yeah, like I'm growing, but only on one side. I don't know that it'll work.
Need one of those shoes with a giant sole.
Yeah, I'll just get different shoes for my left foot if I have to replace my right leg. That's all. And eventually I'll be on stilts. So I find that I write these things down, that gets them out of my brain, so I don't have to think about them anymore. But also I often have ideas for maybe plays I want to write or a board game idea that I want to try. And so I find that if the idea hits me, if I have the luxury of sitting down with my notebook and writing it all out, I write until I can't write anymore. And then I'm done. And if I come back to it, great. And if I don't come back to it, that's fine too. But at least I have a record of it. I don't have to worry about whether or not I remembered it. And if I'm really trying to do something else, you know, if I'm reading at the time, or if I'm just trying to relax, or especially if I'm trying to go to sleep, if I write it down, I don't have to worry about whether or not I'll remember it. I don't have to think about it anymore. So now I can just get on with what I was doing. So it's a production tool, but it's also a relaxation tool for me.
Chris, you think of the last factoid that you wrote?
So the last thing I wrote was an idea I had for a book, maybe wherein everybody has, as a race, humans have decided for one reason or another, that the planet is worth saving, but the only way to do that is to make sure that humans no longer exist. And rather than trying to wipe humanity out, they've basically just decided, okay, there won't be any more of us. We'll age out and we'll gracefully make our exit. And for whatever reason, that's the agreement that has been decided upon, except there's somebody who has learned of a couple that has had a child, and that's against the law. And he's decided that it's humanity is not making a graceful exit. It's not okay to even though they should never have had this child, it's not okay to dispose of the child just because it wasn't in plans for humanity. The idea hasn't gone any further than that. I can just tell you that's the last thing that I wrote down physically that I was like, I don't think this is anything. It could be something. I'm going to write it down. So that way, if it's garbage, it's garbage and it never leaves my notebook. But if it's something that I want to use later, I don't have to try and remember what that idea was.
Nice. Right. Good thinking. And, you know, again, thanks so much for having us here at your bakery, Nina. I was wondering, is there any item, any one item that you're particularly fond of baking? Is there anything you come here and you think, yes, I get to bake this today, and I love doing that?
There's a couple things. I'd say one of the biggest things are bagels for me. I love making bagels. It's just, you know.
Can I ask, are bagels boiled?
Yes. Well, New York-style bagels are boiled. Yes.
How does that work?
So you make the dough, and for me, it's a two-day process. And then you refrigerate the dough overnight, and they're in their bagel shapes. And then in the morning you get up, you turn the water on, you put in some flavoring, and then the boils are bageled, and then they're the bagels are boiled and then they're baked.
Right. Interesting. Did you know that?
I did not know that. No, that's really fascinating. Now, the whole process.
Don't say it, Nina. Mike, how many is in a baker's dozen?
12.
13.
13?
That extra one.
Why?
In case one of them wasn't up to standard, that way they still had 12.
You know, I've been to plenty of donut shops, and when I get...
No. You've been to fake donut shops because they're mass-produced in a farm somewhere.
Hey, either way, man, if that baker's dozen is 13, I want 13.
If you go to DD, right, then the chances are that if you ask for a dozen donuts, you're going to get 12.
Right.
But a baker's dozen is...
13?
13. So they should give you 13.
Yeah.
Well, have you ever been to a place like, I believe, Lox of Bagels in Saugerties? On their list, it says baker's dozen, I believe.
Yeah?
At least the last time I was there, I'm pretty sure it did.
Interesting.
And you get 13 with that.
13 bagels.
Yeah, see, that's important.
Get the right number. Donuts.
Although, you know, having just learned that, although this is probably something that I've learned in the past and forgot. Like, I'm sure if we were to look back in some previous episode, that was something that came up and I was like, wow, fascinating. I never knew that. I'll remember it for the rest of my life. And here we are again. And I'm like, wow, that's really fascinating. I never knew that.
But you will. You'll, in the recesses of your mind, one day you'll be like, hey, it's 13.
13. And it'll prevent me, like when I do order a baker's dozen, from being like, oh, they put an extra one in here. Do I need to go back and tell? Should I pay for it? What do I do?
Baker's dozen.
Yeah, it's just the way that it is.
Nina, what time do you start work?
I start work at about 7 in the morning.
That's relatively
early. It's kind of early, but
No, it's relatively late.
Yeah.
For a baker.
Yeah, because I do a lot of my prep work at night. I'm a night person. I'm not a morning person. So waking up early in the morning is tough for me. So I would rather stay here late and do my prep work.
What's late?
8 or 9 o'clock sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm,
interesting.
Sometimes later.
13-14 hour days.
Yeah. Yeah. They definitely can be. Some days, you know, I get to get out of here around 5:30. It's still a 9 hour day or 10 hour day.
But. So relatively, you know, you, Mike asked you, what I get to bake this. This is fantastic. And you said bagels.
Mm-hmm.
What's the thing you hate making?
Oh, that's a tough one. I don't know if there's anything I hate making. I guess.
Or you say, oh, I need to make 15 of them today.
I would say it's more the elements of the things. Like I make lemon meringue tarts that I'm known for, and the tart shells, I hate making those. Mm. I hate it. It's such a pain.
Because they break or something?
You have to roll them, and you have to set them in a little tart shells, and then you have to bake them, and sometimes they break when you turn them out. It's a pain.
Nick, can I ask, can we taste one later?
Of course.
We've got to taste them, Mike. We've got to taste. I mean, we're in a bake. We can't leave without actually tasting the products.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I'm looking at the menu here. I see cinnamon rolls, muffins, crumb cake, raspberry crumb bars, bagel, scones, Danish, blondies?
Mm-hmm.
What's a blondie?
Blondie, some people call it a blonde brownie. I think it's very different, but it's like kind of like a, in the brownie form, it's got white chocolate chips, walnuts, and pecans.
But blondie to me is a singer.
Yeah.
Now, and I also see brownies, cookies, and I see cupcakes. I don't see a cake in here, but I know that you make cakes.
Yes.
I saw pictures online of beautiful cakes.
I did see them as well, I have to say.
Yes.
One of our previous guests, Lauren, saw the rainbow cookie cake?
Mm, yes.
She said to me on Friday, make sure you bring me back some rainbow cookies. And I said, I don't know if they've got any rainbow. I'll do what I can.
I may have some put away. I'll check.
So plenty of cake. But I'm wondering, have you ever had cake by the ocean? Nina.
I think I have on a cruise ship once, probably.
Nice. And that's the title of your first song, Cake by the Ocean, co-written by Joe Jonas, Justin Tranter, and the Swedish duo Mattman and Robin. And why that song, Nina?
You know, I felt like I just had to. I make cakes almost every day, so I felt like I had to put this song on there. And it's one of those songs I can always dance to. And one of those days where it's a 14-hour day, this song comes on, I still have to dance.
So have your foot tapping.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So I love this song, and I was a big fan of the Jonas Brothers back in the day. So
can I just say, the Jonas Brothers back in the day? That just makes me feel old.
It's over for us, Andy.
It is, isn't it?
Oh, man. We
you know, when
there.
They say, like, old people stay indoors because of the coronavirus, that's us, Mike.
Yeah, that's it. That's all. This is, well, we had a good run. You know, I advise the weightlifting club, the fitness club at school, and I like to maintain a CPR certification. And, you know, it never really occurred to me for whatever reason, like, holy smokes, Jackie is probably a CPR guru master, I suppose. I'm assuming you've had to perform CPR.
Absolutely. Yep. CPR, basic BLS, is something that is a minimum, as well as ACLS, which is advanced life support. And then respiratory therapists are also required, at least for my particular job, NRP, which is neonatal resuscitation. And there are so many other certifications that respiratory therapists can do. There's PALS for PEDS, as well as you know, adult critical care certifications, like, again, pulmonary function certifications. So respiratory therapy sometimes, I think, is a forgotten profession. It's so vitally important, and I'm glad to bring some things to light for people to see just exactly what respiratory therapists do and how important part of a team we are. We bring a lot to the table to take care of patients.
Well, that kind of takes us on to one of the main reasons that we have you on today, Jackie. Obviously, in the last 3, 4, or 5 months, things have taken a turn for the worst in this country, or around the world, rather. Obviously, with COVID-19, can you explain to us, how has that impacted you on a personal level? How has that impacted your job? And how has it impacted you on an emotional level?
I think let's go with the emotional level. It certainly has been quite a ride since the beginning, you know, when we were starting to see Wuhan and everything that was happening there. And then as it started to happen in Seattle and everybody was watching and we were starting to prepare and just really not knowing enough about this and with more and more information coming in, it was really scary not knowing how we were going to take care of all of these people and what we were going to be in for. So I think scared was really my first initial feeling. Mm-hmm. I certainly do remember when SARS was in Toronto back many years ago, and we were watching that very closely, and that was very unnerving and scary. But then knowing how big this was getting, I think scared and fearful was my first feeling. For the hospital, we really started preparing early on, and luckily we were getting a lot of good direction from the state and starting to see what was going down in New York City. It's really interesting to see how in a short period of time we were required to increase our beds by 50%, and as well as, you know, the direction of the hospital was that they were going to stop all elective surgery so that we could accommodate a surge, and a surge that we didn't know how big it was really going to be. There was just no knowing. And just the constant preparing. And of course, the big word was ventilator. And a respiratory therapist is somebody that runs your ventilator. And in the little hospital that I work, we have 4 ventilators. So you can see how we would feel very overwhelmed.
You get 10 people that come in the hospital with breathing problems. There's 4 ventilators.
Correct. Yes.
That's it.
And so luckily we are with Rochester Regional Health. And so our sister hospitals, we were all in very good communication and working well together to figure out how we would best manage the patients of this area.
You know, I wanted to add that Jackie, as a respiratory therapist, of all lines of healthcare workers, you are truly the center lineman in this whole deal of a pandemic. Because in terms of human communicable disease, you have horrific things like Ebola.
Yes.
Ebola is a terrible, nearly, it's like 90% fatal. It can only be transmitted, though, through like touching a person, through bodily fluids and things. Same thing with like HIV. Mm-hmm. And so in that way, despite these diseases being so horrible, they at least can be contained. The other thing about those is generally people are shedding when they're symptomatic. And I think in the case of a respiratory illness, the danger is that it's transmissible simply through breathing. It's transmissible simply by touching your face and then touching something and someone else touches that something. It's way more communicable.
Correct.
And in that way it can be, and also asymptomatic transmission.
Yes.
That's the other problem. And so
could you speak a little bit more about that, Jackie? Sorry to cut you off, Mike.
It's okay.
You know, so you must have a lot of anxiety and fears around the transmission of
COVID-19. Sure. Absolutely.
You must have an acute awareness of specifically why that is. Could you maybe, in an effort to maybe teach somebody who's listening,
yep,
why it's very important to wear